Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Jonathan Evans, as well as the American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
In popular culture, learning is not the only thing that takes place at colleges and universities in the United States. From watching movies and television shows, one might think that college students do more partying than actual studying. But while these stories are aimed at entertaining people, they also reveal a darker side of U.S. higher education. Large numbers of college students drink alcohol or use other drugs. Some even combine the two. In fact, new research suggests that many students turn to drugs and alcoholic drinks as a way of reducing mental stress and dealing with other issues. And experts worry that this could lead to problems for them later in life. Most U.S. colleges and universities offer students some form of mental health services either at the school or off campus. In 2017, the American Psychological Association found that the number of students seeking help at campus counseling centers rose by 30% between 2009 and 2015. Yet, overall college and university attendance rose only by 5% during that period.
Many of the students questioned listed stress, anxiety, and depression as their reasons for seeking help. In order to better understand the issue, the American Addiction Centers asked 980 current and former college students how they dealt with stress. The organization released its findings earlier this year. It found that nearly 60% of the students had turned to alcohol as a way of coping with stress at some point. Around 26% had used medications like Adderall, which is meant to increase energy levels and focus, without permission from a doctor. And nearly half of the students had combined such drugs with alcohol. Lawrence Weinstein is chief medical officer at the American Addiction Centers. He says there are many reasons why college students feel stressed, anxious, and depressed. They are trying to complete difficult study programs, develop relationships, join social groups, and work at part or even full-time jobs. But those are also all issues that every generation of students has faced, Weinstein added. The difference for the current generation is that there is a whole new set of problems for them to deal with on top of the old ones.
This includes the fact that the cost of higher education has risen sharply in recent years, leading to record levels of U.S. student loan debt in 2018. In addition, the admissions process at many colleges and universities has grown increasingly competitive. Since there are so many factors that conflict with one another, it could be more stressful for students to learn to balance the challenges and excitements in their lives, Weinstein told VOA. Yet Simone Lambert argues that the pressures that lead to drug and alcohol abuse may start well before a young person goes to college. Lambert is president of the American Counseling Association. She suggests that in general, one in five people experience some sort of mental health issue during their life. In some cases, she noted, students just entering college are already dealing with things like stress, anxiety, or depression. Lambert said that most people going to college in the U.S. for the first time are 18 or 19 years old. This is an age at which many people are open to experimentation, including trying substances like drugs and alcohol.
They're trying to figure out their identity, their career goals, and just being out on their own without having the supports that they had in their high schools, in their home life, there's a lot of changes that go on, she noted. And unfortunately, substance use is something that is accessible to them at that age that hasn't been accessible before. Lawrence Weinstein points out that the main problem with experimenting with drugs and alcohol at this age is the long-term effect. In the short term, alcohol slows the nervous system and can make a person feel calm. And drugs like Adderall may help a student focus their attention on schoolwork. But the human brain is not fully developed until a person is well into their 20s. Substance use and abuse during developmental periods can eventually lead to problems with memory and the ability to experience pleasure, Weinstein added. And it can also lead to continuing dangerous behaviors later in life. Most campus counseling centers offer programs especially designed to educate students about the dangers of drug and alcohol abuse. They also try to inform students about healthy ways of dealing with stress, such as getting healthy amounts of exercise and sleep. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On today's program, we talk about popular sayings called proverbs. Many you will hear today come from a very famous person in American history, Benjamin Franklin. Now, here is Barbara Klein reading a story written by Shelley Gullist.
Today, we talk about proverbs. A proverb is a short, well-known saying that expresses a common truth or belief. Proverbs are found in most cultures and are often very old. In American history, Benjamin Franklin was famous for his proverbs. Franklin lived in the 1700s. He was a leader of the American Revolution against English rule. He was also a scientist, inventor, and writer. For many years, Franklin published a book called Poor Richard's Almanac. He included many proverbs that he had heard or created. Some of them are still used today, like this one. Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Franklin is also remembered for other proverbs, like a penny saved is a penny earned. This means that money should not be wasted. Here are other examples of proverbs that Americans use. The first ones are about love. Some people say, all is fair in love and war. They mean that anything you do in a relationship or in battle is acceptable. Another proverb about love is, absence makes the heart grow fonder. This means you love someone even more when he or she is far away. But other people say, out of sight, out of mind. You may not even think about that person when he or she is not with you. Which of these proverbs do you think is most true? Another proverb says, love is blind. In other words, when you are in love with someone, you may refuse to see anything bad about that person. Here is another popular saying about love. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Some people believe that a woman can win a man's love if she prepares his favorite foods. Some people are only interested in having a relationship with someone who is very good-looking. You might tell them that beauty is only skin deep. Your girlfriend may be lovely to look at, but she may also have some bad qualities. Or the opposite may be true. Your boyfriend is a wonderful person, but not good-looking. So what a person looks like is not really important. Another proverb is true in love and war or other situations. Actions speak louder than words. It means that what you do is more important than what you say. Sadly, we have no more time for this program, so we must say, all good things must come to an end.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Sudanese officials are seeking to end months of anti-government protests. More than 50 people have died in the unrest. Now, a Sudanese woman is creating street art portraits to honor those killed. Asil Diab lives in Qatar, but earlier this year, she returned to the country of her birth. Diab says she came to honor protesters who were killed in demonstrations against the Sudanese government.
Once I got here, I heard a lot of stories about the martyrs, and it was very emotional, and I just knew that I had to do something about that.
Diab began visiting the families of protesters who died. She then went to work painting pictures of the victims on the walls of the buildings where they once lived. Abubakar Omar's 24-year-old son, Abdulazim, was killed in January. He reportedly was shot by police during a protest. Omar told VOA that Diab's painting has brought back memories of his son. He added that whenever he sees the painting, he feels like Abdulazim is still alive. Diab also creates portraits of those killed in earlier protests, like Adila Mustafa's son, Musab. He was shot during protests in 2013. Mustafa says that she was not present when Diab made her son's painting. When she saw it for the first time, she was surprised. She added that his image is a painful memory for her. At least 50 people have been killed in Sudan since the demonstrations started in late December 2018. Protesters criticized the government for price increases and fuel shortages. They soon began calling on President Omar al-Bashir to leave power. Rashid Diab is a Sudanese artist who many consider a leader of Sudan's modern art movement. He says Asil Diab's graffiti art is empowering the protests. He adds that freedom of expression in painting is very important. He said it gives actual value to the revolutionary act and increases its power and importance. Asil Diab's paintings of protest victims can be found in Khartoum and other Sudanese cities, such as Omdurman and Bari. Diab says her street art provides a way for people to talk about how unarmed protesters lost their lives. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In September of 1901, President William McKinley was assassinated. His vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, was sworn in to replace him. Roosevelt was 42 years old, the youngest man ever to hold the office of President of the United States. Maurice Joyce and Shep O'Neill tell the story of President Theodore Roosevelt and his administration.
Theodore Roosevelt became president at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of rapid changes in American society. The changes were a result of technology. Great progress had been made, for example, in transportation. Almost every American city had a street railroad or trolley. These systems were powered by electricity. Thousands of Americans owned automobiles, and Henry Ford was planning a low-cost version which even more people could buy. Great progress had been made in communications. There were telephones in almost every business office in the cities and in many homes. And Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi had sent the first wireless message across the Atlantic Ocean.
It was clear that the United States had made great progress in technology. Yet many believed it had made little progress in social issues. These people felt America's natural resources were being misused. They felt America's farmers were poorer than they should be. They felt America's industries were unfair to workers. Since the late 1800s, a spirit of reform had been growing in the United States. It started among farmers and led to the creation of a new political party, the Populists. Then organized labor joined the movement. Then middle-class Americans. Not everyone agreed on ways to solve society's problems, but they were united in the belief that social progress had to be made. The future of American democracy, they said, depended on the success of the progressive movement. The man who came to represent the spirit of reform most of all was the new president, Theodore Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was born to a wealthy family in New York City in 1858. He was a weak child with poor eyesight. He spent much of his time reading. When Theodore was 13 years old, he got into an argument with two other boys. He tried to fight them, but he was not strong enough. That incident was a turning point in Roosevelt's life. He decided to overcome his physical weaknesses through exercise and hard work. He lifted weights, ran long distances, and learned how to be a boxer. He continued these activities while he attended Harvard University. After college, Roosevelt married Alice Lee and returned to New York. He became active in the Republican Party. When he was just 23 years old, he was elected to the state legislature. Roosevelt quickly became known as a reform politician. He denounced all forms of dishonesty in government.
Roosevelt's first political career did not last long. He withdrew after 4 years, following the deaths of his wife and mother. His sadness was so great that he could not continue. Roosevelt moved to a ranch in the Dakota Territory of the American West. He began to raise beef cattle. At first, the local cowboys laughed at him. They called him Four Eyes because he wore eyeglasses. They stopped laughing when they found he could do the hard work of a cowboy as well as any of them.
Roosevelt spent 2 years in the West. Then he returned to New York and a life in politics. He became the Republican candidate for mayor of New York City, but lost the election. Then he campaigned for Republican Benjamin Harrison in the presidential election of 1888. Harrison won, and he named Roosevelt head of the Federal Civil Service Commission. Roosevelt fought hard to keep politics out of the civil service. Democrat Grover Cleveland was elected president 4 years later. He approved of Roosevelt's civil service reforms. He asked him to remain in the job. Roosevelt did so for another 2 years. Then he became commissioner of police in New York City. Once again, he pushed for reforms. He removed policemen found guilty of receiving illegal payments.
In 1897, President William McKinley named Theodore Roosevelt Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The United States went to war against Spain a year later. Roosevelt wanted an active part in the war, so he resigned and joined the Army. He organized a force of horse soldiers known as the Rough Riders. They were honored for bravery in the Battle of San Juan Hill in Cuba. Roosevelt was now a war hero. Republican Party leaders in New York thought he would be the perfect candidate for governor. Teddy, as the public called him, won a close election. He soon made clear he would not take orders from party leaders. The new governor proposed controls on businesses. His main targets were companies that supplied the public with water, electricity, and natural gas. He demanded changes in the food and drug industries, and he shortened the workday for women and children.
The public praised Roosevelt's reform efforts. Local party leaders did not. As one said, I do not want him raising hell in my state any longer. Local leaders decided the best way to get him out of New York politics was to support him for Vice President of the United States. The office gave a man very little voice or power in politics. Roosevelt did not want the job for that reason. By then, he wanted just one thing, to be President of the United States. He was sure being Vice President would ruin his chances. But he accepted the nomination at the National Convention. He would run on the ticket with William McKinley. Sadly, he said, I do not expect to go any further in politics. Several months after he was sworn in as Vice President, he was sworn in as President. William McKinley was dead. Theodore Roosevelt became president as the result of an assassin's bullet.
Roosevelt promised party leaders that he would continue McKinley's policies. He said he would move slowly in making any changes. In his first message to Congress, President Roosevelt offered a few new proposals. He asked for a Department of Commerce and Labor to deal with industrial problems. He called for a stronger Navy and for limits on immigration. And he proposed building a canal in Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
Businessmen who feared the worst when Roosevelt became president began to breathe easier. It seemed he was not going to push for reforms after all. But Roosevelt was only following an old hunting rule of African tribesmen. Speak softly, the rule said, and carry a big stick. Roosevelt spoke softly during his first months as president. He would use the big stick later. When the blow came, it was against big business. A group of wealthy railroad owners had agreed to join their railroads into one. They formed a company to control it. The new company would have complete control of railroad transportation in the American West. There would be no competition.
President Roosevelt believed the company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. The law also said it was illegal for any person or group to get control of a whole industry. Since the antitrust law had been passed in 1890, few companies had been found guilty of violating it. So, many people were shocked when Roosevelt announced he was taking action under the law against the railroad trust. He said there could be no compromise in how the law was enforced.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.